From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Representative Haley Stevens on her recent narrow election victory and the race to get Michiganders armed against COVID.
We will see availability to the public of the vaccine by the end of this year.
Also, country singer Rachel Brooke on the year that was made to be a country song and what quarantine looks like for musicians up north.
There's also things that I miss. You know, I spent a lot of time in Detroit playing. You know, you could go out any night of the week and play music. Up here, no.
Plus, a birthday salute to musical legend Yusef Lateef.
Detroit is a bebop town, but it's also an avant-garde town. And I think a lot of it has to do with Yusef's influence.
Those stories coming your way on today's edition of Stateside. First, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, we're going to give you a break from all the news and explore some great Michigan music, from country to jazz.
You know, when you get to Yusef Lateef, I think you're really going much, much deeper into jazz.
But first, Representative Haley Stevens recently won re-election by one of the narrower margins in our congressional delegations. She bested her Republican challenger, Eric Eshakie, by about 3%, a difference of some 10,000 votes. That means Michigan's 11th district, long in Republican control, is going to stay in Democratic hands for at least a little bit longer. This is one of the most closely watched contests in the state. Haley Stevens has made business issues and health care the cornerstones of her short time in office, including the fight against COVID. And she joins us now. Haley Stevens, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
I know that you have been closely following the development of a vaccine to combat COVID. How soon do you think one of the vaccines that is edging closer to regulatory approval, how soon do you think that might be available to the public?
I'm very optimistic that we will see availability to the public of the vaccine by the end of this year. I'm actually getting a briefing on the update for Operation Warp Speed. And this is going to be complicated to get everybody vaccinated. One of the first things that I did as a member of Congress was to invest and vote for the funding to develop a vaccine that was way back at the beginning of this year. But then as we moved towards bigger pieces of legislation, particularly the CARES Act, and you're hearing the voting bells going off right now in my office.
That's what that is? I've never heard one before.
Yeah. Yes. So when members of Congress do any interview, which we now will do from our office, anywhere in the Capitol, the bells go off, and it's actually, we're not voting. It's just that debate has commenced on the floor, that the floor is now back open for debate and addresses.
So I assume when you say that you think that the vaccine will be publicly available by the end of the year, that's probably with the caveat that our healthcare systems will be first in line.
Look, there's certainly a lot of priorities in terms of how we want to get this vaccine distributed and who we want to have get access to the vaccine. There's certainly going to be a round of people who I think are going to be first in line, maybe because of their own willingness. And look, it's not that we are days away from getting this vaccine distributed. We are now at a qualifying place for FDA approval. Once we get the FDA approval and then we get the go ahead for distribution, there's an entity funded through our federal government, a national institute. It's part of President Obama's Manufacturing USA Network. It is a National Institute of Biopharmaceutical Research. I got them several million dollars of funding during CARES Act, have worked very closely with their director and stayed in regular communication in terms of the vaccine distribution. We can think about this in terms of the flu shot. You know, there's a lot of people who go right away as soon as you're able to get your flu shot. Then there are people who are stragglers, and then there's people you got to remind. And then there are some people who don't even get the flu shot, right? And so that's going to be something as well that we will see evolve with this vaccine.
What do we know about the longer-term prospects of vaccination eradicating the virus altogether? Is that something that is even being discussed?
Well, there's certainly a lot of hope for what the vaccine means, but there are some questions around what will give way to the end of social distancing practices and the wearing of masks. We're still in a stop the spread phase. I've read a variety of articles, some that speak to a longer term situation with this virus and its implications on society. And then I've read other articles, scientific reviewed articles that paint to, you know, a picture of optimism, particularly with this vaccine. One of the things that we need to see, though, is we need to see about the antibodies and how long they're able to last in a person. Because it could be similar to the flu shot, that you're getting your flu shot and then you're getting your coronavirus shot every year, depending on how long the antibodies last. That's actually a question I have.
This is a time at which Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's teams are trying to get ready to the extent that they can for the White House. You worked on President Obama's transition team in 2008. What can you tell us about the significance of what's happening right now?
Well, it's certainly a different transition where you can't congregate and be in the normal office setting. I have some very fond memories of being on presidential transition and it being a shadow White House and seeing the president-elect walking through and being able to exchange with colleagues. These are complicated tasks of selecting the right people for big jobs. I was working on the Senate confirmations of cabinet appointees, and there's a lot that goes into it. And I certainly relied on that office setting as well as the relationships that get formed in those settings. And so just like we saw, though, with President-elect Biden's campaign, they have figured out how to do this. They ran a large multi-state national presidential campaign through remote channels. I remember talking to various people on the campaign who were saying, I've actually never even met my colleague in person because we've been remote since March. So there's certainly, you know, a reliance on the video technology that goes into, you know, interviewing or exchanging, as well as a reliance just on being methodical. And right now, what we're seeing with the Biden administration is the core team coming out, a group of experts. The appointment of Ron Klain was heavily lauded. This is a tremendous individual with great expertise. I have seen Ron Klain in action. Remember when he was in charge of the task force on Ebola. And I also remember some people being a little skeptical of Mr. Klain in that role. And boy, did he best everyone's expectations. And so we've got an incoming chief of staff. We've got other core senior staff. One of my own colleagues, Congressman Cedric Richmond from Louisiana, is going to be in a senior role at the White House. He's a senior advisor to the president-elect. And, you know, we're going to see about these incoming cabinet appointments. But one of the things that I have remained very inspired by with this administration is a real focus and a real plan. You know, the first thing they did was announce their coronavirus task force, heavily science-based coronavirus task force, as it should be, a public health focus, as well as being followed up by a real plan for our economy and economic recovery.
I wanted to ask, Joe Biden certainly doesn't seem to be at a loss for how to get his White House up and running, but at the same time, he's not getting full benefit of White House cooperation and recognition. There's been some conversation about what that means in the foreign policy sphere. Do you see other ways in which it might have an impact?
Absolutely. Look, the outgoing administration has got a responsibility to do an exit memo, to do the leave behinds. One of the classic examples that we've heard frequently this year has been about the Obama administration passing along to the Trump administration their pandemic preparedness plan. You heard outgoing White House official from Obama's administration, a gentleman named Chris Liu, repeatedly saying, I met with Trump transition officials on that pandemic plan. But it's not just about the pandemic. We're looking at counterfeit terrorism in the Department of Treasury. We're looking at the running of our Medicare system. I actually submitted to the Congressional Record a statement asking this was back in July, asking my colleagues to join me in pushing for a peaceful transition, no matter the outcome of the election. I wasn't being presumptuous, but I was saying we've got to put our career federal civil servants who help run agencies, do that, the testing of our food safety, veterans benefits. I mean, the government needs to work, and it's run by a president, and you get a very small window right now for these presidential transitions. You know, a century ago, the new president wasn't sworn into March. Now the election happens in November, you go through the holidays, and before the end of January, you've got a new president. It happens very quickly, and there's a lot at stake.
So we'd be remiss if we didn't discuss the election in acknowledging that you've won your reelection, so congratulations are in order.
Well, thank you so much.
That victory did come on a relatively slim margin, around 3%. How do you interpret those results?
Well, one, I'd like to enthusiastically remind everybody about the historic nature of our election, our 2020 election in Michigan. Just record voter turnout. I represent just a little over 700,000 people in Michigan's 11th district, from Auburn Hills to Troy, down to Livonia, Canton, Plymouth, and into, you know, Novi and Milford and South Lyon. And we had almost 450,000 people vote in this election. That is a win for American democracy. Some of our precincts at 90% turnout. And look, I will tell everybody who's listening today and who has questions about this in the future is that I am here in Congress to represent the interests of this district. I have a huge tent of independents and Republicans and people of color, our Indian American community who came and stepped up, and obviously a whole heck of a lot of Democrats who stepped up to be a part of my campaign and to give me this second term. And this was a big feat for a Democrat in a Republican-leaning district, as the only House incumbent that had multi-million dollar super PAC attacks from GOP groups kind of weighing in on my race. That was a little bit different than last time, and certainly being the only House incumbent in Michigan experiencing those attacks. And look, our message was able to resonate, and that's a message of economic prosperity for everyone, for good public schools, and standing up for good quality health care for all Michiganders.
Congresswoman Stevens, thanks for making some time to talk to us today.
Thank you, April.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There's a place in the woods in Michigan, far from the lights of Detroit City, where old school cowgirls sing about getting through the hard years and why lonely hearts are pretty well armed for times like these. And that's where singer-songwriter Rachel Brooks is coming from.
Don't know what kept you from leaving.
Her music warms up your speakers with a feeling from years past when country music was full of wistful twang, maybe a dash of gothic charm, too. Her new album is The Loneliness in Me, and she joins us today from her home in Lovell. Rachel Brooks, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've talked to a bunch of musicians about the shutdown. I just wanted to start by asking what this time has been like for you.
Well, it's been kind of tough. I've been, when it first kind of happened, everything was put on pause. I was working on my record, and I was just about done. You know, I was just about finishing up with the mixing, and I had a few things to do, but it stopped. Everything stopped. So I kind of had to wait. I didn't know. I had no idea, like, if I was going to finish it, if things were going to open up a little bit so I could. But yeah, it was pretty dark. But eventually it kind of started loosening up a little bit, and I got it done. And now it's kind of being released in still the weird year of 2020. But, you know, just kind of making it work right now, you know?
Yeah. You know, there are some folks on the East Nashville scene who have had some success with doing online shows and online performances. But I mean, that's not the venue for everyone. Have you tried that at all, doing online live sets?
I have done a couple live streams here in my home, and it's okay. Like, you know, it is a way that I can connect with people who maybe have never seen my music or been wanting to see my music again or whatever, you know? And so being able to do that was kind of cool, but it's just not the same, you know? It's totally, you know, like even though you're connecting with people, you can interact and talk. It's not like a real personal in the same room connection kind of thing, you know what I mean? And it's weird, but it works. You know, I've been adapting, and I think a lot of musicians have been doing the same thing, and we'll do what we got to do, you know?
Yeah, there's a certain kind of song set, too, that maybe lends itself a little bit more to a live room where you can feel the ambiance.
Yeah.
And you can sort of hear the pierce of the vocals a little
right.
bit more.
Right, and I like that better.
Yeah. It's like talking to someone you're dating over Zoom versus being in the room with them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, can you describe the feel you were going for with the new record?
I wanted to, it's a couple different things. I wanted to have a lot of country songs, you know, like I'm a country person at heart. I love country music. I've pretty much what I like to write. So I wanted to just kind of make it a strong country record, but you know, I wanted to write some sad country songs, you know, like, I don't know, for me, country music is all about the sad songs. It's what speaks to me. It's what makes a country music song, I feel like a really good one. Not that all my songs are sad, because it's definitely not the truth, especially on this one. But I was really trying to, you know, yeah, write some good country sad songs. And
you were definitely going for it on this record.
Yes.
But even the sad songs like are not really the title track, The Loneliness in Me, has a real bounce to it.
I'm a called Satan.
Yeah, that one is ironically, you know, on a whole record of sad songs, that one is not really too sad. It's kind of like a little bit more humorous, I guess, and kind of more upbeat. And that song I'm really proud of, too.
In the video, you're sort of making reference to all the weirdness and isolation of this year. There's a vision of you watching television, getting information about viruses and everything else. And there's a lyric playing under it that says, I was prepared for any trouble that I've seen, thanks to the loneliness in me. Do you think that's true? Do you think that, you know, a life of heartache and heartbreak gets one ready for 2020?
Oh, well, you know, I don't know if there was anybody ever ready for 2020, honestly. But I do think that, at least for me, worrying about things in some ways, it's probably very unhealthy, but worrying about things kind of prepares me a little bit for anything that could happen, you know, like thinking about any possible scenario. It kind of like, all right, well, my brain is prepared for this, so I'll be all right if it ever happens, even though I hope it never does. You know, I don't know if it's, I'm pretty sure that's a common thing, but you know, it's probably something I should work on.
You co-wrote this record with your husband, right?
I did. Yeah, he was. He co-wrote most of the songs with me. There was a few that I had written by myself, and we've always been. I mean, he's a writer. I'm a writer. We've always been writing by ourselves. So this was a first for both of us to co-write.
How'd that go?
It was good. You know, I think it's taken us so long. You know, we've been married for 7 years. We've been together longer than that. And we've both been writers. And I think we knew for a long time that maybe it might be tough to get along, you know, but it did. It worked out well enough. I think it's been like, okay, we're comfortable enough with each other. We're not going to be mad at the other person for, you know, not liking the other one's ideas and stuff, you know. So we made it work. And, you know, now it's like my go-to method. It's like I loved it so much. I loved working with him. You know, he's got such great ideas. And, you know, we can kind of balance each other out, too, on some of the stuff.
I'm a worried man. I don't remember what it was, but oh, it must have been bad.
If you're just joining us, my guest is singer-songwriter Rachel Brook. She has a new album titled The Loneliness in Me.
Never come to understand how in the morning as the sun came up, I found it. Pistol in my hand. God damn, I found it. Pistol in my hand.
You grew up in Lovell, not too far from Grayling, for folks who know where that is, and the beautiful Hartwick Pines State Park, which I think used to be an old logging camp.
Oh, yeah. Hartwick Pines is, yes. Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
What kind of musical inspirations? I mean, I imagine that's Picker's country. I mean, is there much of an old-timey scene there?
In this area, not really, but there seems to be a lot of a folk kind of scene here. And, you know, new singer-songwriter kind of stuff. But as far as old-time stuff, there's not really a lot. You know, I played with my dad. He played bluegrass, but, even that was kind of a newer, you know, 1970s and you know, kind of stuff. So there isn't. And that's been kind of tough, being able to connect with other old-time and, you know, kind of country musicians. But there are few. It's just you kind of got to know where to look, really. You know, there's a lot of old, like backwoods kind of like jam sessions, but you got to know when they are and, you know, that kind of stuff, but not too much.
What kind of music did you play with your dad?
I play bluegrass with my dad. My dad was a banjo player, and he started, you know, playing really young. And then when I got to be a little bit older, I started playing with him. And he's, we played bluegrass and country music until he just passed away last summer.
I'm sorry to hear that. Was he the one who taught you guitar?
Yes, he was. I started showing, like, an interest when I was, like, 13 or 14, you know, and he gave me my first guitar to play on. And then I feel like I really started learning with him when I was about 18. I really started to play the country bluegrass stuff. I mean, he like threw me on a stage. I didn't even know what I was doing. I knew how to play like three or four chords. I was like, okay, I guess I can, you know, I can do this. But I put everything I know to him. You know, he taught me everything. He taught me, you know, everything I know.
Yeah. It can be a lot growing up with another musician in the family. I mean, for some people, that makes for a very natural learning environment. And for others, you know, people kind of feel like they have to find their own thing as well. Was there stuff that, I mean, your style is not inherently bluegrass, but do you think that there are things that carry through to the music you're writing now from the time you spent playing with him?
I think so. I think that everything I write, it comes from my soul. You know, I'm a very like nostalgic person, like just because, you know, like I live in the same town I grew in, that I was born in, really, because it means so much to me to have a feeling of home. And so I think that comes through a lot in my music. You know, I think about the past a lot with my dad, and I think it just kind of naturally just flows in there. You know, it kind of just comes in just because I love it. You know, I loved him. I loved all the times that we spent together. And I think that, you know, in this record and then the future ones, I'll probably have some elements of that home and bluegrassy kind of feel that always kind of runs through, just because I can't help that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. When you listen to bluegrass these days, what do you listen to?
I listen to the old stuff, really. You know, I like the Osborne Brothers a lot. They're probably my favorite. And then, like, I like Jimmy Martin, mm-hmm. but I know that Billy Strings, he's like a new one, you know, like a newer bluegrass picker. I really like his stuff a lot. Yeah, I tend to go for like the older bluegrass. I think it's just like the classic stuff, you know, it's the kind of stuff I want to hear.
You know, not too long ago, you posted a bunch of videos of cover songs. They were all shot in black and white, and they were all really old songs, like Hank Williams and older Willie Nelson stuff. I was wondering what sparked that series for you.
Well, that was actually during, you know, like the lockdown and stuff. I felt like that kind of music is probably, you know, like Hank Williams is probably my all-time favorite singer and songwriter, and also Willie Nelson too. You know, they just speak to me. You know, and during the lockdown, I was just like, I got to do something here. I got to stay somehow connected, and just being able to play those songs, you know, and maybe put them out there for people to hear. You know, it's kind of fun. It's doing what I love to do. You know, it's like being able to kind of put my own feel into a song that I love, you know, Hank Williams and oh, I love that song, Willie Nelson, Are You Sure? That's the one that I put on YouTube. And it's just so good. They're just so sad, you know, and I just love them.
Look around you. Look down the bar from you at the faces that you see. Are you sure this is where to be?
You moved around a lot, and you're living in Lovell these days. I just wonder what you're finding in a small town setting right now that maybe you didn't in bigger cities like Nashville or LA.
Well, there's some, you know, there are a lot of like benefits to living out in the woods in the middle of nowhere. You know, that's really quiet. You can see like the stars, you know, you can see, you know, you can go outside at night and you don't hear anything except for like coyotes. And that's the truth. I'll walk out every night and I'll hear the coyotes like yapping, you know? And to me, yeah, you don't get that kind of stuff in big cities, but there's also things that I miss. You know, I was living down near Detroit for a couple years. I spent a lot of time in Detroit playing. You know, you could go out any night of the week and play music. Up here, no, you can't. And there's not that many people to really, you know, play with. And, you know, I'm kind of both. I can be one day, I can be a complete, like, introvert, and I don't want to see or do anything or be around anybody, and I just want to be by myself. But other days, I miss being able to just call somebody up and say, hey, let's go play. Let's go like jam, or, you know, hey, I'm going to be at this place tonight. What are you doing? Kind of stuff. And so, you know, there's a lot of, you know, pros and cons. It makes me actually think of this song. I love this song by Jonathan Richman. And this is another one that I actually want to cover, but it's called City Versus Country by Jonathan Richman. And it is so, it's like, it speaks to my heart, like so perfect. It's such a pretty song.
I want to live close to downtown, to be near my friends. I want to be close to them, but still be out by the trees in the wind. Heaven both will be hard to find, I'm sure. But then, ain't that the way of the world? I want the city, but I want the country.
Folks who know your catalog a little bit won't be too surprised to hear you mention Jonathan Richman. There's a song that I want to play just a little bit of off your album, A Killer's Dream. It's called The Blackbird.
There's a big blackbird high up in the pine. She's been watching me every night, watching every time.
Could you talk a little bit about the more goth side of your songwriting and what need that fills for you?
Well, you know, I don't really know how it really started. I think it was just, you know, listening to Hank Williams, and I love the Carter family, and their songs are so, they're just so simple, but they sing about a lot of darker things, you know, and but they sing about it with such ease. So back then, I think I was just kind of really into that kind of music, of kind of like the darker stuff, and I was also really listening to like jazz and blues at that kind, and they all sing about that kind of stuff. And to me, I just fell in love with it. And because I was listening to all those kinds of things, I started to create those kinds of songs.
Well, Rachel Brook, we really appreciate your talking to us. The new record is The Loneliness in Me. We're looking forward to a proper tour when things open up a bit more.
Oh, yes, me too. I'm hoping, you know, that in the spring, summertime, I'll be able to travel and move around. And yeah, I hope that maybe I'll see you guys out there.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Like your picture in that frame, your love has
faded just the same, but I'm holding on. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer.
This year, we marked the 100th birthday anniversary of one of Detroit's greatest creative minds. Yusef Lateef's family moved to the city when he was a young child. And in his 93 years on the planet, he gave us music, poetry, prose, and visual art that weren't just unique to his generation. They bring a heightened musicality into our lives that would stand out at any time. With us to remember his work are Rodney Whitaker, Distinguished Professor and Director of Jazz Studies at Michigan State University. Rodney Whitaker, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. And we're also talking with Michael Jewett. He's a longtime jazz and blues host. These days, he's Operations Director at WEMU, but you may remember him for having worked on Hayes and Schumacher's Jazz Revisited. Michael Jewett, good to hear from you.
Good to be here and good to talk to both of you.
Rodney, I know that, as we said, Yusef grew up in Detroit and later moved to New York. Can you fill in some of the spaces there about what his early life was like in Detroit and how that shaped him as a musician?
Well, he was a musician, of course, from Detroit, that went to Miller High School, which is now a middle school. But at that time, it was a high school that produced great musicians like Milt Jackson and the great Kenny Burrell and Frank Rosalino. So many great musicians went to that high school. And from there, he goes on a few years later on to Wayne State to study with the great Larry Teal, who teaches saxophone, but also he becomes a woodwind major where he learns bassoon, oboe, and clarinet and such. And in 1948, he gets a big break and tours with Dizzy Gillespie's big band for 1 year. And so then he comes back to Michigan after touring, and he's a hometown hero.
Michael, Yusef Lateef was not what we think of as a gateway artist into jazz in the way that Miles Davis or Billie Holiday might have been. What would you say about the doors that his music opened up for you as a listener?
I think what, you know, when you get to Yusef Lateef, I think people, and it's certainly been my experience, you're really going much, much deeper. Lateef's music is so unique and creative and adventurous. By the time a jazz listener, music listener, finds Yusef Lateef, they've become, I don't know what you want to call them, hardcore, dedicated, a connoisseur. But it's just a very rich and diverse musical experience that, you know, I've been listening to his music for 40 years now. And it always sounds new. It always sounds different. I find myself, you know, listening to different eras of it, whatnot. And it's always such a rewarding thing because you get the creativity, and his dedication to his craft is just, he's really on his own level. And I think it's really fantastic that we're marking the centennial of really one of the greatest artists any field to come out of Detroit and to come out of Michigan.
If we were to think about his compositions in the context of some other things that were happening musically at the time, I think about Sun Ra's music on the West Coast and some of the some of the originators in the format of New York. Rodney, could you maybe give us some context for what his unique Detroit-based stamp really added to some of the other experimentations of the time?
Well, you know, I think it's important also to mention, although he wrote compositions that were very creative at that time, he also was a great blues player because he had that background coming from Detroit, playing with tons of blues bands before even really playing jazz. So he has that sort of blues feel. He's a Southerner, really, transplant from Tennessee. But also I think that he brought in his composition sort of a Middle Eastern, Asian sound. He was one of the first musicians to really experiment with non-traditional Western sounds and adding that ancient element of music that existed, trying to find a spiritual path within his music. And so when I think of him, I think of him immediately of that. But my two favorite compositions to hear him play, he actually didn't write, and they're both on flute. One is a piece by the great Roy Brooks, the drummer from Detroit, who wrote a piece called Evidence. And that piece for me is significant because it really displays Youssef's Black empowerment side. And then the other piece that I think of is New Delhi, written by Victor Feldman, that was recorded by the great Cannonball Adderley, which featured Youssef Lateef.
I know that during his adult life in Detroit, Youssef Lateef was deeply influenced by the Nation of Islam. It sounds like some of the more international sounds that may have worked their way into his compositions may have sprung from that. Michael, I know that for you, one of the standouts is the 1957 album Jazz for the Thinker.
Yeah, that's a first impression for me, and I think a lasting impression, too. And I think it also points to Youssef, you know, very much an artist. And he conceived of himself as an artist. I mean, this wasn't casual stuff. It wasn't just something that to present yourself in that way. And that image, if their image of he and his band, Curtis Fuller, the rest of the band from Detroit, in front of the Detroit Institute of Arts, in front of, you know, the Rodin sculpture. I mean, that's the image that he presented himself. And this is, you know, he's, you know, 4 or 5 years into his own career, his own leadership of a band. And I think that that just stamps him as being a thoughtful, a creative, you know, that, you know, Rodney was talking about that embrace of African music, Middle Eastern music, Asian music. You hear all those elements. And he brought that kind of scholarly, intellectual approach to the music. But as Rodney also mentioned, you know, a great blues player, you have that really emotional, traditional grounding in his work as well. It's really all there. He's really, you know, a consummate artist in that way.
You can't really talk about Youssef Lateef without mentioning the Detroit album. The subtitle was Latitude 42 degrees, 30 minutes, Longitude 83 degrees, marking us right on the map, recorded in 1969. It's really sort of more of a compositional suite. Rodney, will you talk a little bit about what you like about this record?
What I like about it is that I think what every recording musicians make is really a diary about where they are at that time. And I think as Detroit was making a transition during that time with a lot of things happening, white flight, et cetera, he was very reflective on the town which he grew up, which gave him so much, which gave him a great education, which gave him great opportunities. And he was being reflective, I believe, at that point in his life. So for me, it's beautiful to hear his love and his inspiration for Detroit.
I know you played with Yusef Lateef, Rodney, in 1997, performing at a festival in Italy. What was he like to follow as a band leader?
Well, he was very interesting that he talked a lot about spiritual things. And I remember one night having dinner with him, and I used to drink wine, and he wouldn't allow us to drink wine at his table. But I wanted to sit around, be around, and have the stories told to me by Yusef, so I didn't drink wine. I restrained myself. But he was very, very spiritually awakened. And this piece was that I performed with him was called The World at Peace. And it was a very powerful piece. And unfortunately, at that time, I had just began working with Wynton Marsalis with the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra and couldn't make very many other performances with him. But it was enlightening. And again, Yusef is a hero of mine. I learned about him when I first started playing music at 13 years old, playing jazz.
Yusef Lateef had an incredibly expansive and musical style that was comprehensive of lots of different kinds of disciplines. What did he ask of his bandmates in following him down these paths?
For me, I felt that Yusef didn't give a lot of instructions. And I think he sort of picked musicians that he felt were creative. And I got an opportunity to perform with him through fellow Detroiters like Kenny Cox and Adam Rudolph, who's a percussionist, and Charles Moore, the trumpeter. They all were a part of that group, and they recommended me to Yusef, and Yusef knew I was from Detroit. And he was very into what he was doing. From a creative standpoint, he was very preoccupied with, because he's playing wood flutes, nose flutes, flutes from all over around the world, and woodwind instruments from around the world. So he was pretty busy. And I think he was really consumed with himself and already assumed that I was creative because of the people who recommended me.
Michael Jewett, how do you think the musical landscape of Detroit would be different if Yusef Lateef hadn't put his particular stamp on it?
Well, yeah, it's a his impact was just so deep and so profound. I just want to touch on, we mentioned Yusef Lateef's Detroit, the album Yusef Lateef's Detroit. Recently, the Rolling Stone magazine does these, best of music, best albums of all time. And Marvin Gaye's landmark work, What's Going On, top the list. This is the greatest album ever made. And this is Rolling Stone, so it's mostly pop, rock, whatnot, nothing disparaging against all the genres. But I think actually a companion piece to What's Going On, if you had to pick representative albums to come out of Detroit, which is an amazing musical city, post-World War II and beyond. It's like one of the most dynamic, diverse musical cities on the planet, really. And I think at the core of that is the jazz tradition. Roddy mentioned, early on just about this generation of jazz players, the kind of like the post-Charlie Parker, a Dizzy Gillespie generation of jazz players. And Yusef Lateef is among the greatest of them. But that achievement, Yusef Lateef's Detroit, the album, I think goes right alongside Marvin Gaye's touchstone work, What's Going On. It's a symphonic piece in that it has like a that sort of structure, that sort of scope. It brings in all these different themes about the city. It's very personal. And I think all of those elements in Lateef's music, not just that album, but elsewhere throughout his amazing discography, really speak to what he was about and what that generation of Detroit jazz players gave to the world.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that he produced a body of visual art during his time. Rodney, have you seen much of Youssef's work?
I have not. In fact, I was not really aware that he was a visual artist. I'm not surprised, but amazed at the same time.
How does that fit in with your picture of his creative life?
I mean, it makes sense for him. I think sometimes we sort of underestimate his influence, because when you think about it, I heard stories growing up of many, many saxophonists from New York, when they would tour and come to Detroit, they would go look for Youssef and see where he's sitting in and playing. There's a famous story about a saxophone battle between him and Sonny Rollins, and Coltrane certainly got into the thoris of scales in exploring Eastern music because of Youssef. So Youssef's influence is probably greater than we kind of, you know, I know Michael said that he wasn't a gateway artist, but I think for most of the Detroit musicians, when you're part of that legacy, you're aware of Youssef's prominence in the jazz scene. You're influenced by it. It gives you a sort of an open way. Detroit is a bebop town, but it's also an avant-garde town. And I think a lot of it has to do with Youssef's influence.
I wanted to ask both of you, I mean, not that we have to limit ourselves to one recording, but as we mark this 100th anniversary of his birth, is there one work that you would choose to listen to yourself to remember him?
I'll go first. You know what? And I'm going to go back to Jazz for the Thinker, and really all of those records that featured that great band from around 1957 with Curtis Fuller on trombone, Hugh Lawson at the piano, a band out of Detroit. You know, Rodney was mentioning in some respects, you know, Youssef Lateef is kind of underappreciated in a way. And, you know, being underappreciated or underrated is kind of like a cliche or a trope when it comes to jazz artists. But in terms of what he accomplished as an artist and what he, you know, accomplished as a band leader and every aspect, you know, as a player and everything, I think there's a lot of jazz fans out there who, even though they may be aware of him, are not really aware of the quality and the diversity and the dynamic aspects of his work. But this band from Detroit, and this is an era, you know, mid-late 1950s, where there's a lot of great working jazz bands. But I think the Lateef band with Curtis Fuller out of Detroit is among the best ever. And I probably listen to those albums, mostly Jazz for the Thinker and everything else on mostly Savoy, the Savoy label in the 50s. I rank them as, you know, among the best of the best.
Rodney Whitaker, what would your pick be?
My pick would be the love theme from Spartacus.
Mm.
It's featuring Youssef on the oboe.
Now there is there's a piece of film history I did not know.
Yeah.
He picked this up from the soundtrack of the Kubrick film, is that right?
Yes, he heard it and he loved that song. And I think it still is very creative and very special. I mean, it's much like John Coltrane, My Favorite Thing, even though it's a popular song, he really expresses himself creatively on this composition. So I think it's a wonderful way for common listeners that don't know a lot about jazz as a way to be a gateway, if I can use that word, Michael, to be a gateway into more things.
We've been speaking with Rodney Whitaker, Distinguished Professor and Director of Jazz Studies at Michigan State University. And we've also been talking with Michael Jewett, longtime jazz and blues host at WEMU. Gentlemen, thank you so much for helping us dig in on Youssef Lateef's life. And we're wishing you both safety and a good rest of the week.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Been a great pleasure.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. We are back on Monday. Please do have a very safe and happy weekend.